It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Alrighty.
We said obediently.
That was good. And I appreciate that. Well, hey, let's jump into things because we got a ton to cover in just 29 more minutes. Starting out with the National Energy Bill.
Yeah, it's a bill that passed the House yesterday, 212 to 210. They held it out for a little extra while to allow the White House to pressure some reluctant Republicans into voting yes. So we're waiting now for a companion Senate bill. The good news is that the Puget Sound dodged a major bullet. Joe Barton, the head of the House Committee on Energy and Commerce, inserted a provision as a favor to the corporation BP, which is fending off a lawsuit at its Cherry Point facility.
British Petroleum.
They're fending off a lawsuit from environmentalists saying that the limits imposed by Warren Magnuson in 1977 on oil tanker traffic in the Puget Sound are being violated by the new pier that's being constructed at Cherry Point. Well, the appellate court isn't going very well for BP, so what do? Rather than trying to win the lawsuit, they try and buy Congress. They inserted a provision that basically would have allowed any amount of tanker traffic in the Puget Sound. And this is something that didn't get really much of any publicity at all until there were a couple articles on it this week. But it came as a big surprise, I think, to a lot of people in this region. Nobody really asked us whether we wanted it. Texas Oil Republicans might want it, but we didn't. Credit Dave Reichert. He, along with Jay Inslee and Norm Dix, got together and convinced, as a bipartisan group of congressional people from the
from
the affected region, convinced the House leadership to take the rider out just before the vote Thursday night. I do wonder where Jim McDermott was on this issue. His name was kind of conspicuous by his absence. Adam Smith, too, for that matter, but particularly McDermott. Unfortunately, there are a lot of other really bad things in this energy bill, a lot of pork to corporate welfare, to energy companies, a lot of handouts that and not very much at all in the way of renewable energy technology investment. So
the name of the bill is called something like Gasoline for America's Security.
Exactly what it's called.
The Bush administration has been pushing for its passage for a long time, well, for a while anyway, because they keep saying that, well, we haven't built any new refineries in the U.S. for, you know, since the 70s or something. Well, there's a reason for that. And one of the reasons for that is because building refineries and the operation of refineries produces a lot of pollution and a lot of environmental damage. And one of the reasons that there was a lot of opposition to this bill, particularly among the Democrats, is that the affected areas would be along the coastlines where tankers can come in, offload their goods, and have them go immediately to the refinery and where the refineries would do their thing, and then there'd be gasoline distributed from the coastal areas towards the inland parts of the U.S. So California, Oregon, Washington would all be heavily affected. Those states are mostly Democratic, and so there was a push against this bill. And so far, a companion bill has not come up in the Senate, and it may not come up in the Senate, and we can hope that that happens. If it does, we'll try to let you guys know, and hopefully everybody will have to get on the phone and call their senators and say, what is this? What are you doing?
Yep.
All right. Well, then there was also a defense appropriations bill that was up this week.
Yeah, the defense appropriations bill, in addition to including some $50 billion more for the war in Iraq, which is now up around $330-some billion.
Yeah, remember when in the debate John Kerry was criticized for saying the war might cost $200 billion?
Yeah, it's up around $330-some billion. It's going to go a lot higher. The defense appropriations bill was stalled for a little while in the Senate when there were amendments up for discussion. One of the main amendments that was up for discussion was one that would set limits on the interrogation techniques that U.S. troops could use with prisoners in the war on terror.
Not just U.S. troops, any U.S. authorities at all. Mm-hmm. It includes prisons.
Yeah. And it means that U.S. authorities would have to adhere to the Geneva Conventions, something that you would think is a given, right? But, of course, it takes something like the Bush administration to put all that in question. Now, the Bush administration has said, actually, the amendment passed with an overwhelming majority in the Senate.
99.
With a number of Republicans who stood up and spoke in favor of it. And in fact, the amendment itself was put forward initially by John McCain, who is himself a Republican. Now, this amendment, it does not exist in the House version of the bill that passed the House. So there's going to be a big knockdown dragout in the conference committee where these two versions of the bill are going to be reconciled. The House negotiators have said that they're not going to include it in the bill. The Senate negotiators have said it has to be included in the bill. The Bush administration has weighed in on it by saying that George Bush will veto the bill if it includes the amendment. However, there's another factor that nobody's really looking at. The Pentagon has to have money by mid-November or else everything grinds to a halt. So something's going to have to pass. The big fight is going to be not over whether Bush vetoes the bill, because he's going to have to sign it. The big fight's going to be in the conference committee. So everybody call the legislators who are working in the conference committee.
Yeah, it really is amazing that the threat for the first veto in 5 years by the Bush administration, of course, they've had a Republican Congress.
First veto ever.
Yeah, the first veto ever.
For the Bush administration.
What the issue they would choose to draw a line in the sand over is the right to torture. I mean, they feel that strongly that we have to be able to torture. It's mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm. Moving along, Tom DeLay, looks like things are getting worse for him this week.
Yeah, Tom DeLay has, in addition to the charges that were brought against him last week, this week he's had money laundering charges added to the bill. The money laundering charges that that have been brought against him could lead to a life in prison. That's one of the potential sentences. Now, Tom DeLay has continued. As everybody knows, he's kind of the point man in the House who kind of cracks the whip and makes sure that the voting gets done. On the energy bill that passed, he was one of three Republicans who ran around the House floor while the voting was held open and pushed some of the representatives to switch their vote. So that's how key he is and how instrumental he is in getting issues passed through the House. He is now in deep trouble with not just these charges on money laundering, passing money from Texas corporations through the National Republican Committee to pay for individual races in the state of Texas. He's also becoming a figure linked with Jack Abramoff, the lobbyist who is being investigated on fraud and conspiracy charges to buy votes in the House for his lobbying clients. So that's all pretty bad for Tom DeLay. I think a good news for the Democrats.
Yeah, and we also had another figure connected with Abramoff got into trouble this week is Timothy Flanagan. He was the Bush administration's choice to become deputy attorney general, the number two person in the Justice Department. That nomination had been held up for a couple months because of questions over cronyism. Like so many other Bush administration appointees, he was very politically well connected, but didn't have much actual prosecutorial experience at all to back up the appointment. But he's the general counsel for Tyco, which is where Abramoff works as a lobbyist. And there were a number of questions around his role with Abramoff in trying to push the White House to stop a bill that would have brought into question Tyco's tax-exempt status for being registered to do business in the Bermudas as a tax haven. So the stench surrounding Abramoff widens once again and takes down a key Bush administration appointee this week.
Yeah, in addition, the guy in the Senate in the House who has been the stand-in for Tom DeLay when he stepped down as the Republican leader, a representative named Blunt. His name is also appearing a lot in these investigations of Abramoff. His name appears a lot, so it seems to be going pretty deep in the Republican Party, and could eventually lead to George Bush's door as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, moving along. Looks like G.W. Bush has made another selection for the Supreme Court. It's getting...
yeah. the media has been chock full of articles about what we don't know about Harriet Myers. We want to talk for a minute about what we do know about Harriet Myers. You want to take it away, John?
We know a lot about Harriet Myers. We know that she's deeply conservative. We know that she's deeply religious. She's a member of an evangelical church in suburban Dallas that is one of the leading churches in the country in terms of being anti-abortion and closely connected to James Dobson's Focus on the Family group. She has a long track record of working for corporate America as a general counsel, including for Microsoft for a while, she has been the right hand woman to George Bush in terms of legal affairs for over 10 years. She's very, very closely connected to Bush. She, in fact, there was a comment attributed to her that she considers Bush the most brilliant man she's ever met, which
should disqualify her on intellectual grounds immediately.
Yeah, that brings into question the intelligence of at least two people. it really is, we know an awful lot about her. We know that she's going to be extremely loyal to the Bush administration, extremely loyal to the Republican Party. And that could color her views as a Supreme Court justice for a lifetime appointment. This kind of a partisan appointment is almost without precedent in the Supreme Court. It has happened before, but very, very rarely. And I mean, do you want to?
Yeah. In addition to what Javis said, there are a couple of other issues too about Harriet Myers that should call her candidacy into question. One is that she introduced George Bush to Alberto Gonzalez, and she also has been George Bush's personal counsel long enough that it should bring into question whether she had a role in the sanctioning the Bush administration's right to torture that Alberto Gonzalez
was instrumental in.
She also helped to cover up Bush's, or potentially try to cover up Bush's National Guard record. So, and there are questions about George Bush's involvement in some of the oil companies that he was involved with, and the timing of when he sold his stock.
And
when he sold his stock in those companies And it just raises issues of whether she advised him in those years as well. Also, when she was head of the Texas Lottery Commission, the only public office she has ever held.
No, that's not true. She was on Dallas City Council.
Oh, she was on Dallas City Council for a couple years. Yeah, as a candidate, did not get reelected. When she was appointed to the Texas Lottery Commission, there was a scandal there that nobody really knows a whole lot about, and it seems the Bush administration is doing their best to hide that. In addition, the Bush administration has said they will not release any information on advice she's given to the president, which in and of itself should disqualify her as a candidate. If her work cannot be reviewed, then she deserves a no vote.
Yeah. There's really no... As we've talked about, a lot of the media coverage has been what we don't know about Harriet Myers. That is disturbing in itself, because there's no track record of what her judicial philosophy is. She doesn't have a track record as a judge. She doesn't have any experience. Once again, it's cronyism in action. It's the Bush administration nominating somebody with whom they're personally very comfortable, somebody who shares their political views, but somebody who does not have any relevant experience for the position for which they're being nominated.
Yeah, and let's go over those political views for a moment again. She's anti-abortion. She's anti-gay. She's pro-corporate. The list of corporations she's worked for includes Walt Disney Company, an extremely right-wing company, by the way, Microsoft, Ford, Chrysler, Honda, Citibank, and the Bank of America, which might raise the question of how would she rule in cases that involve those corporations. She's also a born-again Christian. And George Bush has described her as a pit bull in size 6 shoes. Now, we're talking about a position on the Supreme Court where a candidate has to be able to understand various different viewpoints on an issue. Now, pit bulls need not apply, and in particular, George Bush's pit bull.
Yeah, you want a pit bull maybe as a prosecutor. You don't want one as a judge. A judge is supposed to be... unbiased, supposed to be able to listen to both sides carefully and make up their mind. They're not supposed to be able to make up their mind before they've heard the facts in the case, and that's what you're going to get with Harriet Myers.
All right, moving along. Nobel Peace Prizes. They've been handing them out now for another, what, 2 weeks? 3 weeks now?
Yeah, and good news, Mohamed El-Baradei got the Nobel Peace Prize today. Today, I guess, this time.
Yesterday.
In Europe.
Yesterday.
Okay. He has been really quite instrumental in facing off against the Bush administration on a couple of key issues. He was one of the principal people who called into question the Bush administration's description of weapons of mass destruction under Saddam Hussein, and has also, in more recent years, been a voice of caution at the International Atomic Energy Agency around accusations that Iran is trying to procure weapons for military nuclear weapons for military purposes. This is somebody that the Bush administration tried to get out of his third term in office
to
fire him, and This is something of a habit now for the Nobel Peace Prize Committee giving peace prizes to people who have been critical of the United States or United States policy. We saw it with Jimmy Carter in 2002. We saw it with the International the Committee to Ban Landmines in 1997. There have been a number of prizes in recent years where the United States has been at odds with peace, and It's happened once again here. Now, hopefully, this will give El-Baradei some additional footing to pursue a nuclear nonproliferation agenda, and to do it in a manner that emphasizes cooperation and emphasizes international diplomacy, not the military solutions that is the preferred solution of the Bush administration.
All right. Well, that takes us over to international and This Week in Iraq.
Yeah, it's 6 days and counting until Iraq's vote on their new constitution, but all kinds of problems have cropped up. First of all, there's the printing of the constitution. It was originally delayed because the UN had not received a draft that was approved by parliament. Actually, it took the Shiites another week and a half to 2 weeks to get a draft that they could agree on with the Kurds, and one that was voted on by parliament. That was not until September 27th, and the UN hadn't finished the initial print run until just a day or two ago. Again, that was a bare week before the voting was to start. So now distribution of the printed copies began only a couple days ago, and it's going very slowly. Reporters had reported that they were seeing copies distributed only in Baghdad. There's the security issue, and it's also been very difficult to find anyone who wants to distribute it in Sunni areas, and you can guess why. A significant number of businesses that the UN thought would carry it all around the country have refused to distribute it because they feel they will become a target for violence. The very short time window means that it's going to be hard to get it out to the provinces where it is most important for people to see it. Now, the UN says they will have finished printing it by October 14th. Well,
that's 1 day before the election.
Yeah, that tells you everything you need to know about how many people are going to be able to actually see it and read it. In addition, there's the lack of relevancy, what reporters are finding when they interview ordinary, everyday Iraqis around the country is that people are saying, Constitution, what we need is electricity. What we need is clean water. What we need is a hospital that actually functions and has medicine in it. The Constitution, we could care less. So there's that lack of relevancy issue as well. In addition, U.S. troops have been carrying out two major offenses in Anbar province, Operation Iron Fist near the Syrian border, which is just wrapped up in the last day or so, and Operation Rivergate, an ongoing offensive in the Euphrates River Valley. This includes massive aerial bombings, house-to-house searches, mass arrests, heavy fighting with lots of civilian casualties, and, of course, lots of refugees, because the U.S. military's modus operandi is to surround a town or village and force everyone to leave their homes and then go in and do house-to-house searches. Now, no one has explained how you can have this major offensive going on in Anbar province and still have voting there on October 15th. Some U.S. generals say, oh, we will be done by October 15th. Others are saying, are you kidding me? We are not going to be done until December at least. So there's that issue as well.
Of course, that's an area where opposition to the Constitution runs high. we might add. So it's in the interest of the United States to prevent people from voting.
That's right. And on Monday, the Shiite majority in parliament passed a law that would change the rules governing the referendum on the constitution. They said that the referendum would pass if a bare majority of Iraqis who voted on it approve it, but they said it would fail only if two-thirds of registered voters in three provinces voted no. The key word there is registered voters, because that means that everyone who is registered would have to turn out to vote for two-thirds of them to turn it down. Now, in most provinces in Iraq, in most places in the world, it is difficult to get even two-thirds of registered voters to go to the polls, much less to vote one way on an issue. And so what that did is it basically made it impossible to vote the issue down. Well, the UN protested, saying that that rule change wasn't up to international standards. Sunni groups said, why even participate in the vote? We're going to recommend that people boycott. And then the U.S. said, oh my God, we can't have the appearance of unfairness, so you got to change the rule back.
Appearance of unfairness.
Yeah, so you got to change the rule back. And so on Wednesday, the parliament, Shiites and Kurds this time, voted to change the rule back so that it is two-thirds of voters who turn out for the polls in three provinces voting no could make the constitution fail. Now, this may have contributed to a growing Shiite-Kurd split, the fact that the Shiites went ahead and did this without Kurdish consultation. Because on last Sunday, I believe, Kurdish President Jalal Talabani called for the Shiite Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari to resign. This was a shock to everyone. How could the president, the Kurdish president, call for the Shiite Prime Minister to resign? Well, it's very simple. The Kurds want more government posts. They have not received the really juicy, lucrative government posts that the Shiites have doled out to their own members. The Kurds also are pretty disgusted that the Shiites haven't gotten together with them to move forward on resettling Kurds in the city of Kirkuk, which the Kurds want to annex into their northern enclave. And so basically what Jalal Talabani was doing was he was cracking the whip. He was saying, we're necessary. You need us for the constitution to pass. You're going to need us for a new government to form. So you better get with the program. By late in the week, by Thursday, evidently the Shiites had offered the Kurds some reassurance because Talabani went back and apologized. Now, one of the things that the Shiites need the Kurds for is to help them pass the constitution, especially in key provinces like Nineveh. Now, the Sunnis can muster a hefty no vote in Salahuddin province and Anbar province if they're allowed to vote. And their best shot at a third province, one of their best shots at a third province is Nineveh, which has a mixed population of Sunnis, Kurds, Turkmens, Assyrian Christians, and other small minority groups who are against the constitution because they realize that the Kurds want to annex Nineveh or most of Nineveh into a northern Kurdish enclave, which means their minority rights may be completely ignored. Now, there's a good likelihood that the Sunnis, combined with these other small minority groups, could get a two-thirds no vote in Nineveh province. However, in the January parliamentary elections this past January that elected this new parliament that's in power right now, Nineveh was the site of massive vote fraud perpetrated by the Kurdish Peshmerga, who stole ballot boxes, tampered with them, and stuffed other ballot boxes full of ballots that were marked in favor of Kurdish politicians. In one town, U.S. troops who were overseeing the vote joked that there was about a 500% voter participation rate. That tells you what was going on there. And there is every indication, too, that Kurdish Peshmerga are going to be in charge again in Nineveh on the October 15th referendum. So,
with a minimum of international observers present.
Yeah, with a very bare minimum of international observers because of the security situation. So the Shiites need those Kurds to stuff the ballot boxes again and make sure that people in Nineveh don't vote the constitution down. Now, the Sunnis, they have an ace in the hole. They could get Salahuddin province, and they could get Anbar province, and they might get a place that would shock people. They might get the capital city of Baghdad. Now, their ace in the hole is Muqtada al-Sadr. He has not come out either for or against the constitution and says that he won't issue an opinion on it until a day or two before the vote. Now, at the same time, British and U.S. troops have been arresting his political aides and members of his militia in Baghdad and Basra. And that's been making him kind of mad. Now, he could muster a large number of votes inside Baghdad because his militia controls the largest neighborhood in the city, which has a couple million people in it. That's Sadr City. It is also happens to be the poorest neighborhood in the capital city. Now, if we lose Baghdad to a no vote, that would be a major shock for the Bush administration. I don't think that the political process in Iraq would recover from that. So that's something to be watching in the next several days as we run up to the vote, which is scheduled for the 15th. So keep that in mind.
One other thing, incidentally, that came out this week on, and we've been talking about it some in this program before, accusations of government death squads are coming out.
Yeah,
Shia
we
death
have
squads.
Talked about that before. And once again this week, a mass grave was found, 22 Sunni men who were taken from their homes in Baghdad by police, by Iraqi police. They were found massacred and their bodies dumped in the desert. That, again, they're holding that, you know, the Sunni population is holding that up, saying, look, police death squads, predominantly Shiite, targeting Sunni men. And that is definitely contributing a lot to the insurgency.
Just a few minutes left. A report in Haaretz this week.
Yeah, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz had a report this week that U.S. officials had met with Israeli officials to discuss potential successors to the Syrian President Assad, which I think points to the Bush administration's next great goal for the Middle East. I think they're turning their eyes towards regime change in Syria. Now, the interesting part of this is that the Israeli opinion is that Assad, the current president of Syria, is a stabilizing influence in the region, and that trying to replace him would be a bad idea. On the other hand, the Bush administration has some domestic goals for which the war on terrorism and focusing our attention on a foreign war helps them out, particularly when they're in trouble on the domestic front. It rallies American support behind the Bush administration. And so they may pursue this.
Or at least
this.
That's the theory.
That's the theory. And they may pursue this anyway. But I thought folks should know that the Bush administration is already in talks with the Israelis on trying to figure out how to promote regime change in Syria, and that the military option is still very much a possibility.
All right. I also saw this week that Wednesday was a big day where there was multiple papers were published dealing with the recreation of the 1918 influenza virus, which has been stated as being the deadliest virus in the history of mankind, killing upwards of 50 million people.
Yeah, and, two things I think is interesting about that is that right after they got the virus all resurrected, they said, gosh, it's an avian flu virus. Wow, big surprise. We have killer avian flu viruses now. Resurrecting the 1918 one, it doesn't really tell you how that's going to help us with the current killer avian flu virus, which labs are already studying.
Or how to get a vaccine for it that can be widely distributed.
Yeah, and the second thing that struck me is that all of these articles written for public consumption about the 1918 flu virus, reporters and editors seem to need to insert about every two or three paragraphs a little reassurance that this is all perfectly safe. Because, of course, they know that your initial response is, oh, my God, why did they do that? That's so dangerous. A leak of the virus into the population could create a huge pandemic and be extremely dangerous. In addition, telling the world how you resurrected the 1918 flu bug means other scientists in other countries could do the same, potentially for bioweapons purposes.
And in fact, the limited oversight that was done on this experiment right before publication, the National Science Advisory Board for Biosecurity jumped in and included in one of the reports right before publication the quote here: "This research was done by staff taking antiviral prophylaxis and using stringent biosafety precautions to protect the researchers, the environment, and the public. The fundamental purpose of this work was to provide information critical to protect public health and to develop measures effective against the future influenza pandemics." Kind of in addition to what had originally been in the report, which was just the mention of, until now, the exceptional virulence of the 1918 influenza virus has been a question of historical curiosity.
So historical curiosity was the motivator.
Was what killed the cat.
Yeah. All right. Now they have to come up with these justifications. Oh, we need it for health purposes.
And they're going to be working on it right here in Seattle.
But we have other things we could have been studying for health purposes. And
yeah, where in Seattle?
It wasn't necessary.
Down in Belltown. they're going to be
there's a lab in Belltown, monkeys
mm-hmm. with this virus. So
yeah.
All right, out of time. Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat the State. And where can people find Eat the State?
You can find Eat the State anywhere you get free periodicals, bookstores, cafes, good places like that. You can also find us on the web, www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you want to volunteer, give us a call. Our phone number, area code 206, it's voicemail 719-6947.